Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From Ann Arbor to Grand Rapids, communities all across Michigan have to pay more to recycle. That's thanks to a change in China's position on accepting recycling products from the U.S. Brian Ukenna is CEO of the nonprofit Recycle Ann Arbor, which runs the city's recycling services.
What we get paid to offset the recycling costs has greatly reduced, in some cases 50 to 60%, and in some cases even more. And as a result, it's changing the dynamics and the economics of recycling.
Indeed it is. Other communities grappling with increased recycling costs include Brighton and Saline. And in Kent County, the Department of Public Works has taken a more than $1 million hit because of this change in China's policy. Dar Bas is director of that department and is with us now. Dar, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
So, Dar, before we get into just what this Chinese policy green fence has done to recycling, I think a lot of us could use a little primer on just what happens to the bottles and cans and the cardboard and newspaper that we dutifully haul out to the curb every week in our recycling bin, because I think most of us do not give it a second thought once we've done that. So what happens to that?
Sure. And most of us, as you said, when that happens, we just kind of like, it went away, you know, and we take the empty cart back to the garage. So in Kent County, and we serve seven or eight counties here in West Michigan, and it's true for other facilities throughout Michigan and throughout the country, is we have a single-stream processing facility, which is really a manufacturing plant that receives from the waste hauler. They bring in a full load of recyclables after they've gone down the street and picked up everyone's containers, and they dump that on the tip floor. And then from there, we put that into a conveyor system where it's manually and mechanically sorted. So we select out all the cardboard and all the milk jugs and all the, you know, plastic bottles and all the different items that we accept, and then we bale those as single commodities, and then we take those single commodities and we broker those and move them on a semi-truck to a processor that might be local, might be regional, maybe international, where they then process that to make a new product.
Okay. So, and in that, there is something called a tipping fee. What is that?
So the tip fee or service fee is part of really two parts of the revenue stream that allows our facilities to operate. One is the tip fee. When the hauler comes in, he'll tip that on the floor, and we charge them per ton to receive the material. On the backside, we then broker and sell this material, and at least in theory, we're supposed to receive revenue from the selling of this material, which then covers our costs to run the plant, keep the lights on, refurbish and maintain it, and keep it operational for all the material that comes in every day.
And to whom do you sell the material?
It all depends. We use brokers that move some of the material for us. We also broker material directly. Kent County actually brokers all of its material domestically. All of our mixed paper, for example, goes to a mill in Indiana, and our plastic, some of it goes to Canada to be processed. Others, you know, goes to other facilities throughout the Midwest. There's a variety of companies, you know, whether it's corrugated cardboard or plastic or mixed paper, all those various items. There's different companies that then process that for us.
And as you say, I think most of us had no clue that this intricate system of getting rid of this material is in place. So tell us, Dar, about this Chinese policy that kicked in, this green fence.
Yeah, so green fence came into play a year ago, July, when China decided that there were certain materials they were no longer going to take, including mixed paper. Unfortunately, a certain number of brokers were sending material to the Asian market, and there was too much contamination in it, meaning there was trash mixed in. You know, it wasn't as clean a stream as it should have been. And now China is generating its own recyclables through its own consumption, so they don't need as much of international or foreign material coming in their manufacturing stream. So one example that I've used is a year ago, July, China was receiving 200,000 tons of mixed paper a month. And mixed paper is everything from office paper to paperboard to the mail that you get, all those things that we put into the recycling bin. And I would say that today they're taking virtually none. So this 200,000 tons a month that was being received from the U.S. market is now staying in the U.S. market, and it's flooding, and we're choking on this material because we don't have the capacity to process it domestically.
And are there any other countries you could get this stuff sent to?
Well, and that happened early. I think Vietnam, and there were a couple other countries that were taking some of this, but they quickly were overwhelmed themselves because they don't have the outlets or they don't have the processing capability either. And so most of those other Asian countries have turned it off as well, or at least really restricted it.
So, Dar, what kind of financial repercussions has this meant for Kent County?
Well, it's been significant because a year ago, kind of January, we were receiving anywhere from $85 to $90 per ton for our mixed paper. Today, in fact, I just checked with my recycling manager this morning, we're getting zero for it. So we're doing all of this work to separate it, to bale it, to transport it. And right now, global pricing is $0 per ton. And it's just, it's like $1.5 million loss that, well, we're fortunate that we still move the material because on the West Coast, they were relying only on the Asian markets. We're still moving it domestically, but we're not making any money on it.
So we're buying all these finished goods from China, but then we're stuck with all this packaging.
Well, that is certainly worth mentioning. In fact, I know that China just announced, and most of us are aware of the tariff fight between the U.S. and China, and there's others mixed in with it. They just announced a tariff on OCC, or old corrugated cardboard, that now makes our cardboard more expensive and makes other countries' corrugated cardboard more attractive. And we expect another $5 to $10 per ton hit once that takes effect, and cardboard is trading at less than half of what it was. I think it's more in the $75 a ton range, where I think a year ago it was at least double, if not more.
Boy, so when I think of how many of us are just clicking on, for example, Amazon Prime, ship it from Amazon, we're all getting it in those cardboard boxes.
Well, definitely, and that's one thing that we noticed. Our plant was designed around a certain stream of material back in the late 2008, 2009, our plant was built and came online in 2010, where, you know, we were built around newspaper and things like that, which, as you know, readership on newspaper and kind of how that all works has changed dramatically. But there's a lot more corrugated cardboard from online shopping. So we actually spent, I think, almost $1.5 million, $2 million last year putting in new equipment and kind of reworking our plant because we're seeing so much more corrugated coming. And so all these packages are coming, they're corrugated, but our market is being affected globally. And as you say, we're consuming this material, but the outlets where a lot of this material is being generated or originating from have kind of turned off the switch.
So, Dar, you talk about this like $1.5 million hit you're taking because of all this. What kind of options do you have?
Well, either we continue to operate at a loss, which isn't an option. I mean, we have decided to backstop the facility, our recycling center. It's called the Recycling and Education Center. We see it as a community asset. So we're backstopping some of this loss off other DPW operations here in Kent County, but we can't do it forever. And so what we're forced to do, and so many other locations are being forced to do, we have to raise the tipping rate, which is the only other means of revenue, to balance it out. So our tipping rate presently in the last 2 years has been $35 a ton. That, with the commodity sales, was bringing us to about where we needed to be. Our board in June has made the decision that as of January 1, 2019, we need to go from $35 to $65 a ton. And that really doesn't even bring us back to break even, but it gets us a whole lot closer. We can absorb a little bit. We can't absorb multiple millions of dollars of loss. It just doesn't make good economic sense.
And do we have any sense what that higher tipping fee might mean for the individual consumer?
Well, and that's the worry, right? Because as we continue to share our visioning and our desire to see more recycling and more reuse going on, what I've been told is that if a customer is maybe paying $4, $5 a month for recycling, they could see that go to $10 or $12 a month. You know, the processing part of the equation is only about 30% of the overall cost of collecting and moving those materials from the curb and getting it to the processing center, right? It's the truck, it's the driver, it's the transportation. There's other things in play, but it's going to increase it. It's going to increase it for everyone. And we're concerned about it because on one hand, there's a lot of media coverage, and rightfully so, on the fact that there are some markets in the U.S. they're landfilling this material because they have nowhere to go with it. And so residents in West Michigan and in Michigan hear that, and they go, well, why do I even bother to recycle? They're landfilling it. Well, that's not happening in the Kent County area because we can still move it. But then the other side of it is, but now I'm going to have to pay more for having this curbside service, and there's just no way around it.
Do you think people could wind up just recycling less? This could really affect all the recycling habits you've been trying to train people to do?
That's what we're sharing. You know, so we've shared this story. You know, our Board of Public Works and our Board of Commissioners and other elected officials know that. You know, we and others have let the governor's office know because they were so involved in wanting to double the recycling rate and ensure that Michigan could, you know, reclaim its leadership in this area because we're a bit behind our other states around us in the Midwest. But this is going to be a real challenge. We're concerned about, is the commitment there? Do people understand the economic impact and all the other good things that come from recycling? Or are they just going to look at their bill and say, this just doesn't make sense, I can't afford it anymore?
Darbas, Director of the Kent County Department of Public Works, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tune in to Michigan Radio tomorrow for the Environment Report to learn more about how China's policy is impacting our recycling facilities. Later on today's Stateside, an exclusive interview with Abdul El-Sayed, the runner-up Democratic candidate for governor.
I wouldn't change a thing. You know, obviously, when you decide to run for something, you aim to win. But I'm proud of the fact that we built a movement and that our message didn't change at all.
That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of a mandolin, you might think of Europe during the Renaissance or bluegrass music in the South. But it turns out the modern mandolin has roots right here in Michigan. This past weekend, mandolin enthusiasts descended on Marshall for the Marshall Mandolin Summit. They spent the weekend sharing their love for the instrument and learning under world-renowned mandolin players like Don Julin, author of Mandolin for Dummies, and also Mike Marshall, no relation to the town. Stateside Sarah Leeson went to the summit's opening day and brought us this audio postcard.
My name is Derek Smith, and I am a manager product specialist at Northfield Mandolins. We're here in our downtown Marshall workshop. So we, Northfield, hosts the Marshall Mandolin Summit. This is our second year doing it. We just went for it last year, and it was a huge success. This is our second year, and so far so good. The modern mandolin was born in the 1920s in Kalamazoo, Michigan, through the Gibson Company, and is in a lot of ways designed off of a violin. It has a carved arch top. as opposed to a flat top, which would have been found commonly on older style mandolin.
My name is Adrian Begale. I'm the owner and founder of Northfield Mandolins and co-founder of the Marshall Mandolin Summit. That was a crazy idea that Mike Marshall and I had. For me, this is a real homecoming for the mandolin in a way, because of the Gibson tradition in Kalamazoo. We're making mandolins and we're just 30 miles down the road from where it all started. So it's total homecoming. I mean, we feel like really entitled with the sense of a purpose in making the mandolin in Southwest Michigan.
My name is Brian Morris, and I am from Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. I've been playing for about a year, seriously. So I started a little bit before that, and it was kind of off and on, off and on. I love the mandolin because it's beautiful and it sounds great.
I'm Deborah LaMantia. I traveled from Chicago, and I'm here because of Mike Marshall and the other instructors. I'm just very happy and grateful that they are offering this. I'm like so honored to be able to be with these great musicians, and they are so polite and friendly, and we learn so much.
Hi, I'm Mike Marshall, and we're here in Marshall, Michigan.
I'm Katharina Lichtenberg, but I think they named the city after you, Mike Marshall.
It seems they did.
No, maybe you took the name. So I'm also here because of the same reason, and we are both mandolin players, so it's a mandolin summit, so where should we be else?
So we've been doing teaching events like this for the mandolin obsessed for many years now.
He decided that we needed a new kind of American mandolin, and he was one creative fellow. We have a picture of him in his vaudeville outfit. There he is. This is how we all got here, folks. This is why you're here today.
Yeah, I grew up in the South, and that's where, you know, bluegrass is from the South mainly, and as a bluegrass picker, that's the kind of mandolin you would play.
Yeah, because when I was a child, I never heard the word bluegrass, yeah? The mandolin in Germany is mainly played with classical music, so I grew up with thinking that the mandolin is a classical instrument. So, and then in my 20s, I discovered those CDs by, you know, David Grisman and Mike Marshall, and I thought, wow, that's cool. On a mandolin, you can play this, and so, and
you can play cool music on a mandolin? How is that possible?
Right. First, for me, I remember the child is a shape, because I play this ball bag and it's just so round and cute and sweet. It's like a doll. I remember hugging it, and then the tone. It's not easy to produce a nice sound on the mandolin, so you need to push your left hand fingers pretty hard to, not pretty hard, but for a child it's harder to really like push two strings down, and then with a pick to make those metal strings actually sound nice. So it's a little challenge. Then all the styles is just the most exciting thing. And what I like specifically about this weekend is, yeah, just to be with great people I love, you know, and also great colleagues, and also to give something to the students where I think and I hope it will carry them and make them happy, and they will remember the whole year.
Does it feel like you have seen a real burst of fireflies this summer? I know based on my backyard, the answer is absolutely yes. And it turns out 2018 is going down as a firefly boom year, not just here in Michigan, but across much of the country. Sarah Lewis is here with us now. She's a professor of evolutionary and behavioral ecology at Tufts University, and she's author of the book Silent Sparks, The Wondrous World of Fireflies. Sarah, we're wrapping up firefly season here in Michigan, and you say this was a particularly bright season. Why is that?
It really was. And as you say, it's not just in Michigan, but it's been really all across the country. I have heard from the Twitter the world of Twitter that fireflies are really, really doing well in many parts of the country this year. And that's really exciting for me as a firefly scientist. And there's a couple of explanations for this. One is there is, well, we have to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit and look at some of the science behind the spectacle of fireflies. You willing to take a little trip with me?
Yes, please. Pull back the curtains.
Pull back the curtain. So, you know, one of the things to think about is that there's more than just one kind of firefly. So in the United States, there's more than 150 different kinds of fireflies, different species of fireflies. Around the world, there's about 2,000 different firefly species. And so it's possible that some of these fireflies are just really, really doing well. You know, there's some fireflies that are very common. They're almost like weeds, right? So if you looked at a map of their distribution where they're found, they're like sprinkled like stars across the entire eastern United States. They're everywhere from New York City all the way to the shores of Lake Michigan and beyond up into the Rocky Mountains. There's other fireflies that are rare. And so it's possible that we're seeing like a blossoming of some weedy species of fireflies. It would be a little bit like, you know, looking out over landscape and saying, ah, oh, yeah, it's beautiful. It's so green and lush. And then you look more closely and you realize it's all kudzu.
Okay, or crabgrass.
Yeah, crabgrass.
And right? and globally, fireflies have been losing ground, haven't they?
They have, and they've been literally losing ground. So there's a bit of a paradox here. You know, how could fireflies around the world be disappearing when fireflies are doing so well in the United States or in any, you know, local particular area? And I think to resolve this paradox, we really need to kind of look a little bit at firefly, what's going on with firefly biology. So it's possible that they're losing ground overall, and certain firefly species are, in fact, disappearing because their habitat is disappearing. So there are some kinds of fireflies that actually only occur in, like, coastal freshwater wetlands, right? So very, very limited areas, or only at a certain elevation in the Smoky Mountains, or only in along tidal rivers with mangrove trees. So as cities grow, as we build housing developments, the fields, the forests, the marshes, the meadows, the mangroves that these particular fireflies need to survive are disappearing. So some firefly species could be losing ground while other firefly species are taking off.
So very much your weed analogy is great. I mean, it seems like nothing kills crabgrass, so it keeps going. So probably the more hardy, more versatile species, that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, and you know, that might be fine. If you really if you think that having, you know, like one species of fireflies around, it's enough. You know, they're still beautiful, right? But if you care about preserving firefly diversity, we might want to think about protecting habitat for all different kinds of fireflies.
And how do we do that?
You know, we've learned so much about the ecology, the behavior, the habitat requirements of fireflies just in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. So all of this knowledge that we've accumulated now can help us say, okay, well, we know that this firefly population here is really, really unique, and it's beautiful. And, you know, it has these characteristics that make it very attractive for, you know, people. There are many firefly tourist sites now because there are very, very unique species of fireflies in the United States and elsewhere. And so if we want to protect these unique species of fireflies, we know what kind of habitat they need, and we can set aside these areas. A lot of them are already in state parks or in national parks, and say, you know, okay, well, we're going to try to maintain this habitat in a way that promotes fireflies. So the other thing to realize about fireflies, and this is kind of novel for a lot of people, is that the silent sparks that we admire so much in our backyards, in our neighborhood parks, they have a backstory. They don't just suddenly blink into existence to light up our summer evenings.
No, because evolutionary biology tells us there has to be some utility to that beacon. So tell us, Sarah, why? What are the biological reasons these fireflies flash?
Can I go in a different direction?
You can.
So what I'd like to mention is that what we're looking at when we see these beautiful displays is just adult fireflies. We're looking at the courtship signals of adult fireflies, and they are just the tip of the firefly iceberg. So what a lot of people don't realize is that in the U.S., fireflies spend between 1 and 2 years in a juvenile stage where they live underground. And these firefly larvae, by the way, they also light up. They are carnivorous, and they feed on snails, on slugs, on earthworms, stuff like that. When they get big enough, they find a place in moist soil or in moss where they metamorphose into the adults we all know and love. So fireflies in every single stage of their lives need moisture to survive. And that makes them really sensitive to rainfall patterns, not just rainfall during the summer, but rainfall in the spring and in the fall when the larvae are active and are feeding. So one of the reasons that might explain why 2018 is such a great summer for the adult fireflies is that we've had kind of a string of really wet springs, wet falls. We haven't really had a drought in the Midwest for a number of years. As far as I can tell, looking at the U.S. drought maps, the last major drought might have been the summer of 2012 and the spring of 2013. So we've had a string of really, really great conditions for baby fireflies, which promotes adult fireflies, and it's a great circle of life.
That is stunning. So yeah, back up to that. What are the reasons fireflies flash? It's you mentioned adults and babies. Why did nature build that in?
You know, we've been able to trace the evolutionary history of fireflies back through their DNA. And one of the things that we've discovered is that fireflies' light-producing talent, their bioluminescence, first evolved in baby fireflies. So you might kind of wonder, you know, what if baby fireflies need with their lights? You know, they're much too young to be courting or looking for mates. So it turns out that baby fireflies are toxic. They manufacture poisons, toxins in their bodies that make them very distasteful to predators. Like, you know, they live underground, as I mentioned, and so small mammals and birds that might be foraging in the leaf litter or in the top soil layer will not eat fireflies. They're toxic. And so we think that this firefly light-producing talent first evolved as a warning. It signals to predators, just like bright colors would if they were out in a sunlit place, these bright lights evolved in order to warn predators, I'm toxic, stay away from me, don't eat me. And it was much, much later in evolutionary time that the adult fireflies, some adult fireflies, co-opted those larval lights and turned them into the quick, bright flashes that we now associate with the courtship of fireflies. And indeed, for adult fireflies, that's what they're doing. They're using their flash signals, their bright lights, to signal to each other, you know, I'm a potential mate.
Now, you mentioned toxicity with these babies. So when people are saying, oh, it was so cute, my dog was out chasing around in the yard, what do you say to people about that?
So this is something I've noticed on Twitter is a very common thing. Everybody's cats and dogs are really, really interested in fireflies. And yeah, I've seen a lot of videos of cats chasing fireflies. And what I try to do is to just reply to those people, don't let your cat, it's fine for them to chase them, but don't let your cat or your dog eat fireflies. Or, you know, obviously, don't let your kids eat fireflies. They contain toxins that are really, really bad for you. And, in fact, there have been some reported cases of people feeding fireflies to their pet lizards and, you know, within a day, the lizards dying from what is called firefly toxicosis.
Whoa. Well, there you go. Good warning. Sarah, I saw a quote the great Argentine writer Julio Cortazar wrote of the firefly, and this is what he wrote. One can imagine that every time he lights his belly, this light-bearing bug must feel some inkling of privilege. What does the magic of that firefly tell us about the natural world?
You know, I think fireflies are one of the best ambassadors for Earth's natural magic. And that light-producing talent is such an incredible thing, to watch a whole field of fireflies just light up. And, you know, it brings us back to our childhoods. It transforms what looks like an ordinary landscape during the day. You know, it can be a field of soybeans. It can be a backyard. It can look so pedestrian. But at night, when it comes alive with fireflies, it's transformed into something ethereal and otherworldly. They're really, really magical creatures. I think that there's a good reason that fireflies, even though they're insects, and lots of people don't like insects, fireflies are one of the most charismatic animals that we have.
Sarah Lewis is a professor of evolutionary and behavioral ecology at Tufts University. And again, her book is Silent Sparks, The Wondrous World of Fireflies. Sarah, thank you for sharing your love of fireflies with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
On tomorrow's Stateside, the Wayne State University chemistry professor whose firefly fascination started in boyhood.
Certainly was wondering how they did that luminescence and how they were able to flash, which was even more interesting, that they can control that luminescence.
How a 20-year quest to find out exactly what makes fireflies flash led Dr. A. Paul Skop to a discovery that saved lives and turned him into one of Michigan's leading philanthropists. That's tomorrow on Stateside. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark recently sat down with former Democratic candidate for governor, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, for an exclusive post-primary election interview to get his take on the long campaign and what's next.
This was 534 days ago.
I am here today to announce my candidacy for governor of the state of Michigan.
Abdul El-Sayed there officially announced he was running for governor.
I'm doing this because I believe that people matter more. I'm doing this because I believe that our collective potential is greater than our cynicism. I'm doing this because I believe in a future that is brighter than our past, a tomorrow that is greater than our today. I'm doing this because I believe that the challenges that are faced by poor and working black people in places like Detroit and poor and working white people in places like Ishpeming and Big Rapids, those are the same challenges and we have to solve them.
And I'm sitting across from Abdul El-Sayed right now and I'm watching your face as you listen to yourself now a week after not winning the Democratic primary. And I'm watching your face and I'm having trouble reading you. It seems sort of bittersweet. Or what are you thinking about that day 534 days ago?
I wouldn't change a thing. You know, obviously when you decide to run for something, you aim to win. But I'm proud of the fact that we built a movement and that our message didn't change at all. The reasons that I got into it are the same reasons that I stayed in it and the same reasons that I hope to continue fighting for a more just, equitable, sustainable Michigan and America. And so I'm really just proud of our campaign. We punched well above our weight class, and you know, we earned 341,000 votes, which in any other primary year would have been more than enough to take it away running, and showed people a vision for politics that I hope is abiding and I hope will inspire so many people who have been told that they don't belong and that they can't do this to think differently about what's possible for them. And if we've made our politics a little bit more inclusive, if we made our state a little bit more welcoming, if we've moved the conversation about access to universal health care through single-payer mechanisms, standing up to corporations and politics, a living standard of water, 100% renewable energy, then I know that somebody will pick that up and move it forward. So,
and talking about inclusivity in politics, I want to talk a little bit about what it meant for you within sort of the Democratic Party. Things were not always easy, but I do think I want to note the fact that what is it like for you as a Muslim to see Rashida Tlaib likely to become the first female Muslim congresswoman and on the Democratic ticket? You've got three women statewide, Gretchen Whitmer, Jocelyn Benson, Dana Nessel, not to mention the U.S. Senate incumbent. Does the Democratic Party, though, have trouble with inclusivity?
I'm really proud of Rashida and what she was able to pull off. You know, I think it says a lot about our state and our country that a shamelessly Palestinian-American, Muslim-American woman is going to be representing our 13th district, and that's awesome. I think, you know, Senator Whitmer ran an admirable race, and, you know, and a lot of, I think what drove turnout was, you know, what they're calling a pink wave, which I just think is not a good word for it, but women coming out and taking hold of our politics and demonstrating the value of female leadership. I just think that the pink wave idea is just, it doesn't serve to tell how serious I think so many people are about both running and voting to make sure that our representation is fairer and more inclusive. I will say this, though. There are pretty deep inclusivity challenges that we face. I mean, our ticket at this point doesn't have any people of color on it. And the idea that there are more people of color on the Republican ticket than there are on the Democratic ticket should be a point of consideration and, frankly, a point of fear. Because what we did, I think, so well was reach into communities that traditionally had given up on Democratic politics because they didn't feel like they had anything to vote for. And we win when those people are enthused and excited to come out. And we need that in our politics. And I also know that, you know, the nature of institutions is that sometimes the folks who make decisions at the top aren't always forced to pay attention to the people for whom they're making decisions at the bottom. And
did you get the support you needed from the top?
Look, I have my issues with the assumption about the idea that because I was Muslim or because I was Arab American, that there's no way I could win votes outstate. And we just proved that to be untrue. But I think, you know, I think there are institutional biases in any institution, and the work of addressing them is abiding. It doesn't happen in one candidacy. It doesn't happen in one election. It happens because people decide to continue to do this work and to continue to push the envelope. And wins like Rashida's and the fact that there are a record number of women running for office, I think those are big wins. And we just got to keep going.
I think one of the things that I think is fascinating, right, for any statewide candidate is just how much you travel and how much of the state that you see. You've probably seen more of Michigan than my guess is. I don't know. I'm making 90% of folks who live in Michigan. Tell me something about Michigan that I don't know. What should we know about Michigan as a statewide candidate?
I'll just say there's more that unites us than separates us. I mean, a lot of our politicians have made a lot of success telling us that the challenges that people face in Detroit are not the same as the challenges people face in Kalkaska. And having visited both of those cities and an additional 123 cities, I know that the challenges that poor, working, or retired people face are fundamentally the same.
And yet, why isn't there that? Why don't?
Because so few people actually get the opportunity to talk to each other. And the assumption that we'd have nothing to share drives that, right? So many times I'd be speaking with folks in Metro Detroit, where I grew up, and they'd say, well, you've driven out there. What's it like? What are they like? I'm like, well, you know, frankly, they're just like you. And they're talking about the same issues. And the other thing about Michiganders, and, you know, it's maybe this might be a cliche, but we're good people. Like, Michiganders are just really good people. They, like, care to ask how you're doing, and they actually mean it. And I found, you know, campaigning as a 33-year-old Arab Muslim American that the hospitality, the generosity, the courtesy, the smiles that I got were just as warm in Southeast Michigan as they were in Northern Michigan or Western Michigan, even if people didn't agree with me. I remember having a conversation with a gentleman. He said, you know, I've heard about you. I don't think you and I agree on much, but you seem like a really nice guy. And I want to tell you, I wish you luck person to person.
And let's share a pasty together.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. And so that ability, I think, to transcend our differences in geography or in demography is going to be the future of our state. And we've got to figure out how to make sure that we're sharing a coherent conversation about our collective Michigan.
And yet that's not what wins campaigns, right? Instead, it's the attack ads. Instead, it's, you know, dark money. I think most folks wish that there was this sort of utopian society in which you're talking about, and that is the reason why that they keep voting the bums out and don't trust the swamp, right? And yet it comes to election time, everyone sets their watches, and there go the negative ads, there goes the dark money claims. I know not one person can wave a magic wand and fix that. But now that you've been in it and been in the middle of the tornado, the eye of this storm, what are some things that candidates could do to change the tone? Because let's be honest, you were part of some of this, right? And it kind of encompasses everyone, whether you go in wanting to be positive or not.
What I'll tell you is that I'm really proud that our campaign never ran any attack ads. And I'm proud that our campaign never took any dark money and never took any corporate money. We wanted to live on our ideals. And yeah, you know, that meant sometimes articulating very clear differences in both policy and kind of the brand of politics that we ran from others. But I will say that there's really two ways that campaigns can decide they want to move. They either can fearmonger or they can articulate what is beautiful. And what we always wanted to do was to talk about what's beautiful in the world that we want to build. You know, and also to articulate why certain ways of doing politics and certain positions weren't going to get us there, but always to focus on what was beautiful and on what unites. And I hope that we succeeded in doing that. I'll also say that one of the most corrupting things about our politics is the money, is the way that big money drives a certain impersonal approach to politics. You know, 60% of the average campaign, and we'll just say my campaign raised $5 million and we got outspent tremendously on $5 million. So much of the money just drives the sort of impersonal kind and impersonal brand of politics that takes us away from the individual one-on-one conversations that are so much more nuanced and so much more thoughtful than, you know, a 30-second ad. And so we've all got to figure out not just how to take certain kinds of money out of our politics, because that money comes, you know, comes with some asks on the back end, but also how do we just bring down the price tag? How do we make our politics more about talking to people and having a conversation rather than talking at people with talking points and 30-second ad spots?
I'm Zoe Clark, and we are talking with Abdul El Sayed, candidate for governor. Earlier, you mentioned your age, so I'm going to remind folks you are 33. You've got a long life ahead of you. So what, let's say that's, you know, one third of your life. What's the next two thirds looking like? What's next for you?
I went to medical school because I wanted to learn how to heal people. I wanted to become a doctor because I wanted to be able to do something about the differences in access to a healthy life. I ultimately, you know, went to medical school and realized that public health was where I wanted to be, because our politics and our society is what dictates and patterns access to a healthy life in the first place. And then when I came to appreciate that so much of what we can do in public health is dictated by our politics, that's when I decided to run for office. For me, the path has always been the same. It's about trying to find true north, about how we service ideals, about how we build justice and equity and sustainability into our world. I'm not going to get to fulfill that as governor, but, you know, the path hasn't changed. I'll just walk it in a different way. And so I don't know what's next.
Will you be campaigning for the nominee, Gretchen Whitmer?
Certainly. You know, she and I have yet to sit down. I want to be as beneficial to her ticket as possible. And I look forward to having that conversation about how I can benefit. I do hope that a lot of what our campaign showed are things that she can assimilate into her message and into her campaign, because, you know, we showed what's possible when you reach out to communities of color and progressives and young people. You know, what we cannot have is a Bill Schuette governorship where, you know that this heir of the Dow fortune, who literally has made huge amounts of money simply because he was born into wealth, with a company that has tremendously hurt our environment. We cannot allow this individual to continue to push forward a politics that hurts poor and working people, that hurts our environment, that takes away access to healthcare. And so I am committed to making sure that I do my part to prevent that. And that means putting my shoulder into helping the Whitmer campaign get across the finish line. And I look forward to having a conversation about how I can best do that.
And would that include wanting to be lieutenant governor?
We haven't had that conversation. Look, I want to be as helpful as possible. And, you know, if that means that that I'm asked to join the ticket and, you know, we can talk about how we move forward in a direction that is consistent with our shared values, then that'd be great. And if not, then I'm committed to making sure that that she is governor in January.
Abdul El-Sayed ran for governor as a Democrat in Michigan, lost to Gretchen Whitmer, who will be the nominee, who will run against Attorney General Bill Schuette. Abdul El-Sayed, we will watch and see what comes over the next few weeks through the campaign and 534 days from now.
Well, Zoe, thank you so much for the time. And I really appreciate the opportunity to have met so many incredible people, and hope I can reflect the goodness that I was shared into the work that we do 534 days from now.
And you can listen to an extended version of Zoe Clark's conversation with Abdul El-Sayed. Just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. For nearly 2 years, Detroit's water department has been phasing in a costly, controversial drainage rate. Opponents call it the rain tax. The phase-in is now complete for residential properties, but a group of Detroiters is fighting it in the courts. Joey Horan from Outliner Media reports.
On a warm summer night in Detroit, Russ Ballant stands in the parking lot of the Bel Air Luxury Cinema on 8 Mile and Van Dyke. He's staring through a fence at the illuminated Northeast Water Treatment Plant, where he worked for 5 years as plant operator.
On this landscape, under this grass, you have a raw water tunnel coming from the Detroit River about 7 miles away.
Ballant explains the complicated and expensive process of getting clean drinking water to Detroiters. But he's really here to talk about the other side of the coin, what the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department drains from properties. The department now charges customers based on the amount of hard surfaces on their property, like driveways or roofs. The logic behind the charge? Any rainfall or snowmelt that doesn't get soaked into the ground ends up in Detroit's combined sewer system. The city has to treat that combination of sewage and drainage before discharging it into the Detroit and Rouge Rivers. Ballant says the rate is not only too expensive, it is also an unconstitutional tax.
The drainage fee meets all three definitions of a tax. And if it met just one of them, it would be a tax. But it's a tax, a tax, and a tax.
But more on that later. Ballant's first stop on this late June evening was across town at the Jefferson Avenue Presbyterian Church. That's where the Board of Water Commissioners held a public hearing on proposed rates for 2019.
And now you're telling me that on top of the water bills they're already paying, because I happen to have gotten a house with a long driveway, that now I'm going to have to pay additional drainage charges?
That was Sylvia Orduño of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. Like dozens of other residents at the meeting, she wanted answers. Instead, the board attempted to cut public comments short, and tensions reached a fever pitch. There's a lot packed into that rage. The water department continues to carry out annual mass shutoffs for residents behind on bills. Meanwhile, Detroiters are forced to shoulder the financial burden of a system that has billions of dollars worth of legacy debt, miles of aging infrastructure, and is massively outsized for the current population of the city. And now, instead of paying into their own city's coffers, a large portion of Detroiters' money goes to the Great Lakes Water Authority. That's the regional body that formed at the tail end of the city's bankruptcy in 2014.
What happens in the wake of the Great Lakes Water Authority is that Detroit has to support itself on its own footprint. So my best interpretation of the drainage fees really had nothing to do to correlate with drainage, but was really just a crass calculation to say, how are we going to maintain our head above water?
That was Peter Hammer, director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State University. Palencia Mobley, deputy director of the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, says the rate was simply updated to create a uniform billing structure.
The new rate actually is fair because every single customer is being charged based on their specific parcel's impervious area.
But is it fair if the department started with a revenue hole and worked backwards to find a rate to fill that hole? A lawsuit against the city says that would make it a tax. The suit was filed by customers like Roger Skrzynski. His family has owned Central Avenue Auto Parts since 1929.
I basically was like, I'm going to lose my business anyway, but I'm not going to go out without a fight.
Court filings show that Skrzynski paid $350 a month for drainage before the new rate went into effect. After the change, his drainage charge shot up to more than $4,200 a month. That's a 1,200% increase.
In my life, I've been through a lot of rough stuff. Nothing has scared me as much as the government coming down on me over rainwater.
To reverse the government's decision, Skrzynski will have to prove that Detroit's drainage rate is a tax, not a fee. That would put it in violation of Michigan's Headley Amendment, which requires voter approval for any new local tax or tax increase. The case is currently on the docket of the Michigan Court of Appeals. For Michigan Radio, I'm Joey Horan with Outlier Media.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.